get someone from work to Mexico and maybe a dead battery, you'll be appreciated. I'm just putting it in your hands, because otherwise nothing's going to happen. The word halacha means esaderech yelchu bo v'esamase asher yasu. In the pasuk in Parshas Yisro, this is the way we walk. We walk in the way of halacha. And my view of the word halacha has always been a very broad view. A broad view. Not limited to particular disputes. Beis Shammai, Beis Hillel are arguing about Ner Chanukah. Right? We're only a month away from Chanukah. So do you go from 1 to 8 or from 8 to 1? So we follow Beis Hillel. So that's halacha ke Beis Hillel. It's much deeper and broader than that. Halacha, at least the way I understand it, embraces a large range of issues, some of which are in fact particularistic. Do you go from 1 to 8 or from 8 to 1? But others resist such a narrow definition, and they apply to a broader way of looking at things, of conducting ourselves. What halacha is not, that's also important, is agadic statements, Kabbalistic statements, statements which do not have practical import. So, for example, the Rambam writes in his Pirush Mishnayos in a number of places that we don't have a halacha, we don't decide in such matters. Some people are learning Perek Chelek, I know, here in the morning. So, Perek Chelek is a dispute whether the people of the Dor, Hamabul, or Anshei Sedom, this week's Parsha, they get Olam Haba, they don't get Olam Haba. So Rambam writes, there's no halacha. Either they'll get it or they won't get it. They'll find out or they found out. We're not going to give it's not a halacha. They don't paskin. And for that same reason, we don't paskin. I would not view it as under the rubric of the term halacha. However, I do view as part of the term halacha, even issues which are not found in specific, as we like to call it, sifim in Shulchan Aruch. And I found in particular paragraphs of the code of law, which is called the Shulchan Aruch, but perhaps transcend that. It's what sometimes people call, it's an important term, the fifth part of Shulchan Aruch. Now, those of you who know that Shulchan Aruch is divided into four parts. What's its fifth part? You can't find it in print. It is how appropriate halachic authorities will interpret the specific words in the Shulchan Aruch from a broader perspective. That's what's called the fifth volume of Shulchan Aruch, or Chelek. And people who don't have that are viewed by traditional experts in the field as being not capable of rendering decisions even within the four official volumes of Shulchan Aruch, because they can misinterpret or misapply things which are there in an inappropriate fashion. Given this broad definition of halacha, nonetheless, it must be said that the core of halacha is in the nitty-gritty. But even this nitty-gritty, as we shall see this evening, has more application than people are often want to think. Okay, so we've spent a few minutes in describing and defining the first word of the three-part title for this year, which is halacha. I'll take questions at any time. Please.
On this fifth part of halacha, since it's not written down, then how would we judge, or who's going to make the decision as to who is following it and who is not, who is out of the realm of following it?
That's a very good question. I could ask even a better question. Before we decide who is following and not following, we should decide, well, who is deciding in the first place?
That's what I mean.
Who's in and who's out, as the previous question of who's making, who is deciding on what basis? That's an excellent question. It's a very good question. It certainly has ramifications for our topic in general, but halacha engaging modernity, that is a very good question. This requires a longer discussion. We'll talk about it a little bit to answer your question, but we cannot answer it fully in this forum, because it will prevent us from getting into the topic we're supposed to discuss this evening in a more full way. Who decides? So it's generally assumed that an individual, in order to be able to render a decision in such matters, has to have an appropriate breadth of knowledge, as opposed to in a different field, you have specialists. And a specialist will render a decision and in this particular specialty, doesn't have to be conversant with the broader literature or the broader topic. Here we require someone who has a breadth of knowledge, who has an understanding of the realia of what's happening in this particular case and in the community that he's for whom he's deciding, and has, of course, the most important prerequisite for anyone who's rendering decisions, which is Yirah Shamayim. Not enough to be in the know. You have to have the Yirah Shamayim, which is the prerequisite for any psak. I would refer you to the introduction to the Sefer Igros Moshe, for Moshe Feinstein, the very first volume, in which he writes there that an individual has to have this Yirah Shamayim before he can offer any opinion in any novel matter. In order to say the halacha kebeis Hillel, and you go from 1 to 8, not 8 to 1, you don't have to have any Yirah Shamayim. You say that's what it is. That's found in the Talmud. It's found in the Shulchan Aruch. That's easy. But to give a decision where it's a little bit more gray, you have to have the prerequisite of Yirah Shamayim and the other prerequisites we spoke about earlier. Okay? And then, once that's given, must everybody follow? So that's a very important question, which I'll just touch on very briefly. Very briefly. The Rambam is the, as often is the case, main man in his articulation of the rule book, the guidelines. And he says that whatever is decided in the Talmud is by definition binding on all of Klal Yisrael. One cannot say, well, I'm going to disagree with the Talmud's decision because I'm more learned and I have my pshat in the Mishnah is better than Rava's pshat in the Mishnah. This doesn't work that way. Once the Talmud has been redacted, that is binding on all of Klal Yisrael for eternity. And he gives a reason. Rambam says it's a rationalist. He gives a reason. The reason he gives is because all, when he says all, he means almost all, obviously, all of the sages of Israel got together in one particular place and came to these decisions. And therefore they're binding not only on that generation, but on all future generations as well. However, writes the Rambam, since that fateful meeting of the minds that took place in Babylonia some 1,500 years ago, it hasn't been repeated. Why? Let's ask why. So the cynics will say what they say today, but the Rambam, writing in his day, said it was logistically not feasible because the people were spread out into different countries and it was hard to get from place to place, and they couldn't all find a common ground. Oh, that was certainly the fact when the Rambam was writing what he was writing in his time. The Rambam lived some 800-900 years ago. Times were difficult. You really couldn't get from place to place. And of course, there were those that will say, but today, that's clearly not the case. Today, people go from place to place in a flash. There are airplanes. Well, why can't we then overcome the problem that the Rambam has delineated for us? The answer is, of course, we can logistically, but I guess after all these years of it not happening, it's unlikely between you and me to happen until the Mashiach comes. I'm just giving maybe it's a pessimistic, but I think I consider myself a realist or pragmatist more than a pessimist. I can't see it happening myself till the Mashiach comes. Hashiva Shavtena Kivarishona. Then there'll be finally there'll be a Bezdin HaGadol in Yerushalayim. And they'll make all the decisions, and all these machloks that we have will be brought to an end. But we're, as much as we wait for Mashiach to come tomorrow, nonetheless, we have to be prepared in case he doesn't, Chas V'Shalom. So that's why we're speaking about these things. And until that time, the likelihood is that there's going to be many, many issues which are not clarified definitively in the Talmud, where it's a subject of dispute among later authorities, Rishonim, Achronim. We call them Achlokas Apostle. The Shulchan Aruch has Yeshamim v'Yeshamim. Some say this and some say this. Once in a while they'll say Halacha this way, Halacha that way, and at least leaves it open. And then it could be those who disagree with the Shulchan Aruch and say the Shulchan Aruch said this, I don't agree. And if they have enough stature, they have followers. You're allowed to disagree with anybody who came after the Talmud. The Rambam said, in his time, the medieval times, we are technically speaking permitted to disagree with anybody who lived after the redaction of the Talmud, even Gaonim, or Savaroim, who came, who knows, 500 years before the Rambam, since they lived after the Talmud was redacted. They have, of course, a presumption of being correct. It's only a presumption. If you can disprove them, or feel that they made a mistake, or they can say a different opinion, you're entitled. How much more so could we dispute later decisions from more recent halachic authorities. Nonetheless, you want to dispute the authority of the Shulchan Aruch, you have to have those prerequisites. You can't just, a guy walks in, okay, I don't like what the Shulchan Aruch says, I disagree. Who are you? So technically speaking, you can say what you want, but if you don't have the knowledge of that particular area, and you don't have the breadth of knowledge with the Yiras Shamayim, then your opinion is likely not to be followed either by anybody, or if you happen to have a bunch of followers because of the position you occupy in a particular community, so it's likely to be short-lived. Not gonna go much further if you don't have those credentials, if I may say. Okay, so I hope that answers your question, at least in part. Good. So we spent, I guess, a few minutes defining what we call halacha. Now I have a much more difficult term to define, which is modernity. I guess we'll get to engaging, and that's the verb. Let's first see what the two nouns mean. What does it mean, modernity? So, I have an interesting volume, just to show you, which is entitled, look at this, Engaging Modernity. It doesn't say halacha engaging modernity, it's engaging modernity. That's why I'm not guilty of plagiarism. Engaging modernity means, how do you, rabbinic leaders in the challenge of the 20th century. So he's defining modernity for the purposes of this volume. There's nothing wrong, this is a part of the Orthodox Forum, edited by a very fine person, Dr. Moshe Sokol. And it's about 20th century rabbinic leadership and how they deal with modernity and the 20th century leaders. The rabbinic leaders are, respectively, Rav Kook. These are famous names that I assume they're household names by people in this room. Rav Kook, Rav Soloveitchik. Those that they occupy the major portion. And then at the end, they have Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. Not everyone knows who he is, but he's a tremendous individual. And Rav Yitzchak Herzog, who was the chief rabbi of Israel. So those are the two major and the two, I'm using the word minor only in terms of how many pages they occupy in this book. We don't rank people over here in this year.
It's not so modern anymore.
It's true, too. These are 20th century giants, and now we're in the 21st century. You're certainly correct in that statement. What interests me now for the moment is an article by one of the authors here, which attempts to define modernity somewhat. What is meant by the notion of modernity? Does it designate a specific time, a certain orientation, or perhaps a definite quality and content? What does it mean, the root meaning of the term? What does modern mean? What is modern? What's the shoresh, if you will? What does it mean? Here and now, contemporary, just chronological. Whatever goes now. I think that the shoresh of modern is mode, or as they say it in Yiddish, mode, or style, or the fancy of the particular, the zeitgeist, or whatever people are thinking at that particular time. That's the mode. And if you're with today's mode, you're modern. If you're not, you're not modern. So whatever's going on today, if we buy into it, then we are modern. If we don't buy into it, then we are not modern. That's in a simple, what he calls over here, a chronological basis. However, he says, over the course of time, modernity has a different connotation. The quality of change and innovation, cultural dynamism, social and intellectual transformations characterizing recent generations in contrast with their predecessors. So modern people understand innovation itself to be a desirable value in its own right. This is to say that if you lived in 1600, and you abided by the principles of the 1600, you were not modern. According to the first definition, you were modern. Because at that point, you were modern. That was the latest style of 1600. And you were buying those clothes and speaking that language, you were modern. But in 1600, people were not interested in changing things. We're just treating just the old time way. 1500, 1400, you go back as far as you want to go. However, according to the second definition, in those times, most people, there were always exceptions, were not categorized as man. That's the second definition. And the third definition, modernity is also associated with a certain specific content, with the particular tendencies, beliefs, and values which have emerged in the new world. And he gives a list. Autonomy of the individual, control over nature, critical thinking, historical consciousness, spontaneity, creativity, expressiveness, authenticity, and the like. And it's associated with certain social, ideological, and political movements, with specific streams in the arts and literature, technological and industrial developments. Okay. So these, of course, are subject to change. So now they talk about post-modernity. We now spoke to them in the post-modern age. How do you do that? Well, you can, because you want to contrast yourself with what came 20 years ago. Okay, this is the, I'm just giving you from, reading from this this volume, a definition of how, what they consider to be modernity. But for our purpose, we're going to perhaps combine some of these things and discuss it from our historical vantage point. And here, the handouts that I gave out, I didn't make enough, I apologize. But the source is a volume called Judaism's Encounter with Other Cultures, Rejection or Integration, which we could, you know, paraphrase for our purposes, right? Halacha engages modernity, rejection or integration. Right? That's really the same question. Yes, sir?
But other cultures may be just as conservative.
100%.
Medieval Islam. 100%.
So you're right. They're saying other cultures, it may, if you will, be not as precise a term as you would have asked for. I think it's a very beautiful volume, and I'm not here to criticize. I think it's excellent. And the particular article that I'm be referring to exclusively, there are four articles here by four great people, is one by Rabbi Schneer Lyman, Rabbi Dr. Schneer Lyman. Some of you may know his pedigree. He comes from an illustrious family. His father served as a principal in a major Jewish institution many years ago. He is a very outstanding scholar, an expert in Bible and history. He's an expert in almost everything. He really is a tremendous Talmud Chacham. He's a Yirei Shamayim, a scholar, a very special person. I'm privileged to know him personally. And I even spoke to him, I called him about this article for a reason which I'll get to towards the end. So I did copy a number of his pages, which you should have in front of you. If you don't have your subject, look on the person next to you, where he's describing this the transition from what he calls pre-modernity to modernity. That is the chapter heading. So when did it happen? Obviously, according to some of the definitions, it happens every day. Every day was yesterday, is already in the pre-modern, today is modern. But from the historian's context, when did it happen? He tells them when it happened. So I'm starting on page 156. Some of you have it in your handout. And we're not going to read every word, but just give you a flavor. In the pre-modern world, so Jews were second-class citizens. They couldn't live where they wanted. They were Pale of Settlement. They had to pay special taxes to live in a particular place. And as late as 1744, and we're giving a date, that's a so-called pre-modern. Why? The entire Jewish community was expelled from Prague, despite the fact that Jews had resided there for centuries. So it's firstly, it's a question of whether Jews were accepted by the society around us. In pre-modern times, not. And in modern times, yes. Now, this, of course, we're not discussing the Holocaust. That happened in the modern age. So, there are always flukes here and there. And there may have been flukes in the other direction before this, quote, pre-modern age. He's just obviously focusing on Ashkenazi Europe, which was, most of us here are from that, come from that world, from Ashkenazi Europe. And that's where things were in 1744. There wasn't much action here in the United States of America at that time. But that's where it was. Then he says, it's much more important, the Jewish communities were religiously autonomous. That means that rabbis and their courts were empowered by the state to adjudicate internal disputes that affected the Jewish community alone. And they could collect the taxes solicited by governmental authorities. They had internal discipline by the Kehillah structure. In other words, the Jewish and Christian communities were mutually exclusive, with no easy access in one another. You had to belong by governmental edict to a particular religion. See, we're Americans. We can't even believe this. What? because we are born in our mother's milk in the separation of church and state. It wasn't that way. It wasn't that way. There was state-sponsored religion. And, of course, the Christians were the majority. The Jews were a minority. But they were given minority rights with the ability to collect taxes and to spend whatever they were given to spend the way they decided. They, of course, being those in charge. There was an authoritarian system. And here's a key line. A Jew could opt out of the Jewish community almost exclusively by an act of apostasy. If you weren't ready to join the Christians, you were, whether you liked it or not, a part of the Jewish community. Like it or not. And since the Jewish community was run like this, Shalosh Shudos, I read a few lines of how the Jewish community was run with complete authority. You had to follow the Rav, the Rosh Hashiva, or else there was even corporal punishment. So that's how it ran. It's the pre-modern. So what brought this system down? Now, from 1744 is the only day we had so far. Now we're 2009. That's quite a few years. But what, if you have to give a series of historical benchmarks, what brought this pre-modern world down? So Dr. Lyman gives us a number of fascinating developments, both within the general world, and as we shall see soon, even within the Jewish world. So, the next paragraph begins. The Age of Enlightenment. Now, the Age of Enlightenment is not a particular event. It's hard to put a year on the Age of Enlightenment. The next one, the French Revolution, we know when that happened. I remember from high school, world history we studied, and they had a regent taught it in high school. So last I looked, it was 1789. Is that correct? I think so. So that's French Revolution. He puts the Age of Enlightenment first, which I can understand. You know, there's a Renaissance and what can. Gradually, people became more involved in science and more involved in thinking in a more enlightened way. And their aftermath would bring an end to the pre-modern world as they ushered in modernity. So here it is. We'll say, just to make to round it out, we'll say that modernity began in earnest in the 19th century. We're now at the beginning of the 21st century. We'll say that until the first half of the 18th century, it was pre-modern. It started to shake around that time. And by the beginning of the 19th century, we were well into the transition, which of course took place at different times in different parts of Europe, into the modern world. By the time the century was over, we could say the entire European world was, quote, modern. For the Jews, modernity would be a long process, beginning in the Napoleonic lands. Napoleon, as you know, was a modernist. He was the first one to grant us rights. Now, I'll interject for a story. I have to at least one story if I can. I try to tell at least one story. Some chassidim tell all stories on Motzei Shabbos. Maybe just one story. And the story is a story which relates to Napoleon. We know from our world history, and Napoleon was trying to master the entire civilized world, and he had the troops to try to do it. And in the 1810s, he was marching east, trying to conquer the Russian lands, and he fell the same way as Hitler would a century later to the cold Russian winter when it's in the tough supply lines. But we all know the story. So Napoleon is marching, and he's about to take over the heartland of the Jewish community. So of course, the Jews are now in a pickle. Are they for Napoleon or against? Not that anyone asked them to vote. There was no vote. Are you voting for or against? And the Jews weren't really, at that point in time, very militaristic. It wasn't like, you know, a century later when the Jews were fighting in armies. I don't think they fought too much in either army. But we believe in the efficacy of prayer. Tefillah. So do you daven for Napoleon or do you daven against Napoleon? That's as far as we can go. The story is told that the crushing, grinding poverty and subjugation that the Jews suffered at the hands of their respective East European lords was so devastating that almost all of the great Hasidic masters were davening for Napoleon. It's a disaster. We're living in disastrous conditions in the Polish-Russian heartland. Comes the white hope, the White Knight, Napoleon in the Shining Armor. He's already given rights to our Jewish brothers in France and in other Western countries, and to bring us to us this fantastic improvement in our living conditions. And so they're all going to daven for Napoleon. There was one exception, the story goes, and that was the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, who was thriving. That was the time when he was active. And this is how the story is told by the Chabad Hasidim, but they probably have the right spin on it, at least certainly from their perspective, that the Lubavitcher Rebbe was very fearful of Napoleon, because he knew that if Napoleon would come true, their physical situation would improve drastically. But he foresaw a complete disintegration of the Jewish community and religious observance. And he was right. The Rebbe was right. I'm not politicking any other Rebbes, but he was right. But the question was, who's going to win? So we know. You've heard me say it so many times. All these decisions are made on Rosh Hashanah. Right? Ala medina tzboyoma eza lachera veza lashalom. So in Rosh Hashanah, it will be decided. That fateful year, was it 1812? Was it 1814? I'm sure you ask the experts, they'll tell you exactly what year it was. It was 1812? Those in the Napoleonic Wars are going back and forth. So whoever can dive in best, that he's going to win. Story is that the Alter Rebbe, being a very smart man, he figured, you know, the first one in has the best shot. So the story is, he got up early in the morning and davened as quickly as he could possibly daven. And he blew the shofar with all his might. May God defeat Napoleon. Other Rebbes also had, tremendous breath of vision. And by the time they got up to daven and to blow shofar, the other way they said, in their phrase, this is how the chassidim say it, the Litvak hot gevunen, the Lithuanian, Lithuanian had a broader definition, the Alter Rebbe was considered Lithuanian, the Lithuanian Rebbe, he won already, he beat us to the punch, and the Kodesh Baruch already received his tefillahs and his tkiyas, and Napoleon is doomed. That's how the story goes. So, it's a story, Motzei Shabbos still Hasidic stories, but it shows to us that, you know, it started with the word Napoleon taking root in Germany, because Napoleon fell. And there weren't that many Jews in France in any event, but Germany was the first beneficiary of that wave of enlightenment. It was a large community, and ultimately spreading eastward. Some communities would first confront modernity in the 20th century. They had to be very cloistered in order to about to be said about that. Okay. Key turning points in the history of modernity were the promulgation of the Edict of Tolerance by Emperor Joseph II of Austria in 1781-82. That's already still in the 18th century. And the granting of citizenship to the Jews in France by the National Assembly in 1790-91. So you have places where the Jews are now going to become first-class citizens. This hadn't happened before in the European continent. This will lead to the granting of citizenship and civil rights to Jews in almost every modern European state by the end of the 19th century, as we had mentioned. The upshot of these political gains was the undoing of all that defined the state of Jewry in the pre-modern period. So the same as non-Jews. The ghetto walls came crumbling down. Jews entered into European society with a vengeance. I once heard on one of Rabbi Wein's tapes that the unfortunate reality of Jewish history is that almost always the Jews assimilated as much as the Goyim would let them. It's a very sad commentary. I remember it rang in my ears when I heard it. I used to play his tapes in the car. So he's a tremendous Chicago twang. It's a pleasure, you know, he's driving on the highway to hear what he has to say. But that I remember. That we, unfortunately, it's a condemnation of Am Yisrael. We're supposed to be Betach Bodet on our own. And unfortunately, as the Gemara tells us in the Masechta Sanhedrin, that Hashem said, I would like you to be Betach Bodet, that you should be elation alone with security, which means you have the option to assimilate, and you don't take it. But if you don't do that, if you'll try to assimilate, unfortunately, it's not going to be Betach Bodet, but Chalila Eicha Yoshva Bodet. Eicha Yoshva Bodet means Churban. And in the very famous piece, it became so famous, I'm not going to read it to you, it's right behind me, the Meshech Chochma in Parshas Bechukosai, and he was writing Before World War One, it was impossible for anybody, even the Meshech Chochma, to predict what was going to happen in the next decades. He was saying that unfortunately there are places where assimilation has transpired, as we said in The Vengeance, and the place that he chose is, in his famous comment, Yachshavu sheBerlin hi Yerushalayim. What came into it? He picked Berlin. They thought that Berlin is Jerusalem, and he predicts, based on history, that whenever we assimilate, will come a storm that a Kodesh Baruch Hu is going to bring and destroy everything. What can I say? Chacham Odef Minov. He, no political pundit, I'm sure, nobody, and when he wrote it 100 years ago, could have possibly even thought that way. Impossible to have even been imagined. But he said based upon history. He was a historian. Okay? Then he goes into the philosophers. I'm going to skip this idea. But on the next page, 157, this is the general change in non-Jewish thinking. Ultimate faith was placed in rational man. Rational man. So, if a Jew was rational, so he could get along well, otherwise not. This is what happened in the general society which affected the Jews. A sad footnote. A very sad footnote. And that's what's on the main paragraph on this page 157. While all this was taking place, rabbinic authority is engaged in an act of self-destruction. That's very sad. But you have to give a background. And we have to learn from history. Isn't that so important? As we know, we're supposed to learn Chochmah Bagoyim. As it's been famously said, one who does not learn from the mistakes of history is doomed to repeat those mistakes. So we have to learn from the mistakes of history. What's the mistake he's talking about over here? It was a Shabtai Tzvi, a false messiah, in the 17th century. During his lifetime, people thought he was the Mashiach, and some rabbis were still somehow convinced that that there was some truth to what he said. So, in 1751, that's we said, that's the midpoint of the 18th century. We're now moving from the pre-modern to the post-modern. The Satan got in. The Satan of Machloikas crept into Klal Yisrael. That Satan is so powerful. Once he creeps in, I give you a piece of advice, ladies and gentlemen, run away from him. That Satan is destroys every good thing. So what do you have? Rav Yaakov Emden, who passed away in 1776, accused his contemporary of Yonis and Eberschitz, who passed away in 1664, of being a secret believer in Shabtai Tzvi. Is he right? Is he wrong? They're still fighting about it. And the new papers come out all the time in the 21st century. Was he right? Was he wrong? Back and forth. It's immaterial for our purpose. Why? Because it was a disaster. What happened? All the Rabbonim would get involved in this dispute. Okay? So what happened? If you're in the controversy, it's called the Emden Eberschitz controversy, the supporters of each rabbi put the other group in Cheirim. What was the upshot? Every rabbi was in Cheirim. So I ask you a question. If every rabbi is in Cheirim, is the Cheirim meaningful? No. So, you know, later, the government took away the right of a rabbi to issue a ban. That happened at the end of that century. As a matter of fact, he quotes later, Rabbi Paul Hamburger, who was the Avbezin of Hamburg, left the rabbinate because they took away, according to some, because they took away his power to issue the ban. As we discussed over Shalosh Shudas, the ban, or what it stood for, that the rabbis couldn't impose their will in the community, that's how it was in pre-modern times. But before the Goyim took away we in effect destroyed it ourselves. If every rabbi is in Cheirim, the word Cheirim is meaningless. And of course, it is meaningless to this very day. Any Cheirim that you hear about is completely meaningless. The only one exception is the Cheirim of Rabbeinu Gershom. Rabbeinu Gershom, 1,000 years ago, put a bigamist in Cheirim. And unfortunately, even that, there's some people who are flouting it. I'm going to go with that for a totally different discussion. Forget about it. Then, there was a fight between the followers of the Baal Shem Tov, called the Hasidim, and those who opposed, misnagdim, that means opponent, made another rift in Klal Yisrael. So rabbinic authority would never again retain the statute held in pre-modern period. Forget it. You can no longer impose rabbinic authority. Its power would be wielded only among those who voluntarily consented to abide by it, or in the few instances that continue to derive its authority from the secular state. Okay? So this is the change from pre-modernity to modernity. Okay? So the question is, how do you respond? How do you respond? What do you do when this happens? What do you do? So, we're going to be discussing tonight one particular issue, which I believe, is very much halachic. So we've defined halacha, we've defined modernity. Each one has a narrow definition and a broader definition. What does it mean, engages? Engages means, well, how does one react to the other? Well, we saw before, this is entitled rejection or integration. Do you reject it and try your best to fight off modernity? Or do you try to integrate? We're not discussing the third possibility, which means accept it completely and forget Judaism. That's a third possibility, which unfortunately is largely the dominant one in today's world. But we're discussing within the, what we'll call the community of the committed. Within the community of the committed, are we going to reject it, or are we going to integrate it? Or as the individual who suggested the series phrased it, are we going to confront it in a sense of confrontation, you know, not going to really be part of it, or embrace it? Those are the words that were used by this individual in our shul. And there's slightly different words, rejection or integration. Okay, reconcile. Okay, fine. A lot of good words will work. So what's fascinating is that just as in his description of 20th century responses to modernity, engaging modernity in that book, it's set forth in the form of describing great rabbinic leaders and how they dealt with it. Just to remind you, Rav Kook, Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Weinberg, and Rav Herzog. In the same way, amazingly, Professor Lyman does exactly the same thing. And he introduces rabbinic leaders of the 19th century. The first one is someone that most of us probably never heard of. A show of hands. Who ever heard of Harav David Friesenhausen? I'm not surprised. I never heard of him either until I read it. A great, tremendous, tremendous man. He was born in 1756, and he was sitting and learning for 30 years. And then, believe it or not, he went to Berlin. And he went, did secular studies a couple hours, wrote a couple of books. And he got a haskama from the chief rabbi of Berlin in the late 18th century. And he made a whole curriculum of how school should be run. He was a precursor of the Torah and Derech Eretz movements. He made an entire system. It was rejected. It was rejected. Rejected. He met with the Chassam Sofer, and he wrote him a beautiful haskama. Chassam Sofer. He's the one who was famous for his expression, what? Chodesh Osim in HaTorah. Because he was fighting reform. He quotes in 1819, he quotes my colleague, he's a president, a dayan of a community of Uhel in Hungary. He knew him when he was much younger, the most distinguished students in the yeshiva of Firth. Where was Firth? Anybody? Germany. There were tremendous yeshivas of Germany still then. Many years of studying Torah. He is the Yirei Shamayim. And he's worthy of an appointment as a rav in a larger community. Can you imagine that? So he foreshadows the great rabbis that are the main subject of Professor Lyman's article. Rav Yaakov Etlinger. Everyone knows who Rav Yaakov Etlinger is? I hope. The Oral Chaner, one of the greatest rabbinical leaders of his time, of the 19th century. He had a colleague who was not well known. His name is Chacham Bernays, who was his colleague, contemporary. They were very close. They They were together both in the yeshiva and in the university in Würzburg. They went to Würzburg. They were the first went to actual university studies, and they're somewhat next generation great contemporaries. The next generation of Shamshon Rafael Hirsch. I'm sure everybody heard of him, and his colleague and contemporary Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer. Okay, now we pick up those who have 164. All attempted, those four, to establish rabbinical seminaries whose curriculum incorporates secular study and bore a remarkable resemblance to that of Friesenhausen. Only Hildesheimer would succeed in doing so. And he gives you the three ways to respond to modernity: assimilation, isolation, and confrontation. But confrontation, in his parlance, doesn't mean rejection, it means dealing with it. So assimilation was out. That's giving up the ship. That's becoming not observant. Isolation, he felt, would be harmful in the long run. So confrontation was the only viable Jewish response. It was a daring stance, a lonely one, and it's a footnote in Jewish history. But now we have the halacha. The halacha for tonight is a very simple halacha. It says in the Gemara Masechta Kiddushin, we mentioned it last year in our relationships in halacha, that a father has an obligation towards his son. And his obligation towards his son, we all know very well, is to teach your son Torah. This is found in the Gemara Masechta Kiddushin on Daf Chav Tesem and Aleph. But for those who know the Gemara, you not only have to teach your son Torah, but there's another obligation over there. What's that called? Lelamdo umnus. To teach him a trade, a profession, a way to earn a livelihood. These are halachos. Even in the strict sense of the term, not certainly in the broader sense. It's halachos that are quoted in the Sifrei HaPoskim. It's found in the Gemara. So we have to understand how will the Jewish father teach his son. It's a strict halacha. So it's clear that in the pre-modern world, you taught your son Torah. If you taught him a trade, you taught him a trade in the literal sense. He'd be an apprentice to become a cobbler, a tailor, and these kinds of, or maybe to have a small little store. The way the Jews earn their livelihood, by and large, 90%+ over centuries. There was no medical school. There was no law school. There were very few big businessmen. You can't really train a businessman. They didn't have MBAs in those days. They had a chush. They weren't allowed to go to most schools. That's how it was. So that's then it was nothing to talk about. But I'm going to begin, which is, in what, for those who have it, the big bold print, Torah education in Western and Central Europe at the start of the 19th century. Here we are with our first halacha in the series, the halacha of Torah education. One manifestation of the devastating impact of the Enlightenment on the West European Jewry was the utter collapse of the traditional yeshivas almost overnight. The famous yeshivas of Metz, Frankfurt, Mannheim, Fürth, Karlsruhe, Altona, Hamburg, Halberstadt, and Prague were still flourishing in the middle to late 18th century. There were yeshivas. We spoke at Shalosh Shudas of the yeshivas in the 17th century. That was totally pre-modern. But even in, as he says, into the middle of the to late 18th century, they were still flourishing. By the beginning of the 19th century, right, all you had to have was that, you know, French Revolution, Enlightenment, granting of citizenship. All of a sudden, the whole thing went out the window. Because the yeshivas were flourishing, sad to say, only because there was no alternative. Sad to say, but that's the reality. Once there was an alternative, everyone jumped headstrong into the alternative. Precipitous state of decline. Students were no longer attracted to the yeshiva. Traditional chadarim, which had once served as feeder schools for the yeshivas, were disappearing. The social mobility that was made possible by modernity led students to seek other more progressive forms of education, Jewish and secular. And he gives an example of such an institution in a footnote. 1804 in Frankfurt, molded several generations of reform Jewish leaders. Whoa, a new word. Reform. There was no reform in the pre-modern world. There was one Jewish community, and it was, to use our present term, Orthodox. obviously a present term. You didn't have to say Orthodox then. Jewish meant Orthodox in all those years. Sure, there were those here and there, small minority that didn't observe. It doesn't make a difference. The definition of a community was the Orthodox community. Wealthy Jews, now under the influence of a new set of vows, withdrew their support of the yeshivas. Ein kemach, ein Torah. If the Gevirim are not going to support the issue, they're going to collapse. Right? Reform. Reform. Introduced denominationalism into what had been a traditional and united Jewish community. In other words, the Reform, they're the breakaways. We're the old show in town. They became the, quote, modern show in town. Because they were new. Let me just turn this. They were new, and we, quote, were old. Okay. He quotes over here a great German Talmudist of Mendel Kargau, who lived from 1772 to 1842. He's the author of Gidulei Tara, a tremendous gaon. I've seen his svarim. I mean, he knows everything. A man of who knew. It's just not working. It's not moving. Who knew everything, was a tremendous gaon. Okay, on page 165. I'll add the page for today. A transitional figure who witnessed the rapid changes that were overtaking Orthodoxy. Remember, he passed away in 1842. In one of his responses, he wrote, quote, "The rabbis who preceded me were exceedingly great in Torah. Nonetheless, had they devoted themselves to even a smattering of secular study, instead of," and he said, I wouldn't use these expressions, "wasting precious time trying to explain away curious midrashic passages by a sophistry consisting of joining together unrelated passages." Woo! 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 I hope he's not talking about my Shalosh Shudas Torah. But whatever. "We would not be inundated now with the destructive forces that are tearing down traditional Judaism." Oh, wow. Wow. Now, I don't know. Is that really true? Let's say they would have studied, the rabbis would have studied secular study in starting when he was born in 1772. Would that have been enough to stay the incredible attack on traditional Judaism? I don't know. I mean, he's saying it. I'm just quoting it.
Also, whose translation is this?
That's another story. "Despite these ominous developments, with an occasional rays of light, 1795 was still the 18th century. The first Orthodox Jewish day school, that is, an elementary school combining Jewish and secular study, whose express purpose was the preparation of traditional Jewish Judaism, was founded by Tzvi Hirsch Kozlin, a merchant in Halberstadt." Can you imagine this? It was called Hasharat Tzvi, came a community school, separate classes for girls in 1827. Can you imagine that? Girls education. I'm sure in Eastern Europe didn't exist. I don't think it existed by the non-Jewish community either. He was a real modernist. A high school in 1866, and thrived until the Nazi period. Okay, I didn't know about it. Okay? Who were the graduates? Azriel Hildesheim. Wow. Rav Shamshon Frohl Hirsch, his grandfather. Rav Mendel Frankfurter, who died in 1823, made a school in Hamburg. And I think most important is this quote. These are all, you'll say, oh, these are German scholars. Germans are somehow don't have the full confidence that we have in our classical Rabbonim. Look at this now. 1816, Rav Shmuel Landau, died 1834, son of the Noda Behuda, Rosh Avezin of Prague. Now Prague, true, Prague had a certain Western flavor to it. As we said before, the yeshiva of Prague was also devastated by this Enlightenment, long before it got to Poland. But still, Prague is Czechoslovakia, Prague, Prague. Morale was Prague. These are Noda Behuda was Prague, and his son took over. Look what he writes. This is incredible. 1816. I would tell you now, nearly 200 years later, if this man got up and said this in, even in Riverdale, people would raise their eyebrows. If he said it in Williamsburg, I don't know what would happen. I don't know. They're not taking a Christ. "When a child is 6 or 7 years old, he should be taught the Torah in Hebrew, together with a translation into German."
Vernacular.
Okay, now it'll be English today. "As it appears in the Hebrew Bibles printed in Berlin, Vienna, and Prague. He should master German and related subjects of importance. Anyone lacking the ability to read and write German cannot succeed in today's world. Just substitute English. Same thing.
True.
Same thing. He will not get entry to nor become expert in any profession. It wasn't true in the old years. In the pre-modern world, where you were working for the local shoemaker or a carpenter or maybe diamond dealer, I don't know who you were working for. Either you can get along with Yiddish, if it was insular, and if not, a smattering of the local language, if it was Polish or Russian, but they might know a little bit, was enough. Didn't have to write. You had to count. You had to have arithmetic. You had to know. That's true. You had to measure things, but then to add things. That's it. It is obligatory upon every father to teach his son the language and the laws of the state in which he lives. Can you imagine what's going on? This is a note of Yehuda's son. Now this, he still has the credentials. The note of Yehuda's son. Everyone holds the note of Yehuda, right? This is his son, his successor, his chief rabbi of Prague. Moreover, parents shall see to it that their children grow in Torah and Derech Eretz. Whoa. Rav Sham Shmuel Nefrol Hirsch was, I think, 8 years old at this time. Maybe he already had a patent on it, but I don't think so. The children shall pursue both, moving from level to level, until they are 10 to 12 years of age, each according to his ability. What happens then? 10 to 12, what were they? Today we call it 5th grade, 7th grade. When he is 12 years old, a judgment shall be made concerning his ability and character. If it is appropriate that he continue his studies, a determination will be made. In other words, some people wouldn't study anymore at all. They'd go to work. That's what he's saying. 12 years old, they'd go to work. They'd be apprentices in various professions.
Everybody.
Yeah. But there's some who have a gute Kopf. Let's put him into studies. But what studies? What? What studies? A determination will be made whether he should pursue secular study at age 12. Now, he probably had his daf yomi, his shi halacha, but he's pursuing secular studies at age 12. Or Talmud with Rashi and Tosfot leading to the rabbinate. If study is not for him, he should be taught a vocation or business skills, each according to his inclination, starting at age 12. Now, you can't say that today anymore. Partly things have proceeded so far that no one's going out to work at age 12. It's just too early. But could we say it maybe at age 14, if they're not going to go to work at that hour, at that age, they're entering into high schools at 14. Some who want to become rabbis should learn fully, with a smattering just to get by in other areas. And others should be the reverse. They should be studying, we'll call it college preparatory studies, to get into the best college they can and to make the best living they can, with a smattering of Torah studies. That's what he's saying.
And he's right.
I think he's right. You think he's right, but you say this anywhere, you get hit from both ends. Okay. So I'm going to end the shir. We try to start on time and end on time. Okay. It's a good question. I plan to talk about all these things, but after we conclude the shir, we're going to go off the record so people can speak freely, and you please give me a list of topics that you'd like me to discuss against this broad definition of modernity, whether it be technological, whether it be sociological. There's so many things that have changed in recent times that you may want me to talk about, which I'm happy to do. This is just the introduction. But I will conclude by revealing a secret. Shalashuddis, I read a very passionate defense of the, we'll call the Frankfurt platform of Sham Shmuel Nefrol Hirsch, which was issued in 1963 after it was attacked by a very venerable Rav Dessler, the author of Michtam Elio. Actually, it was printed in Michtam Elio in the third volume, 10 years after the Rav Dessler's death. And an anonymous Torah sage responded in something called Hama'ayan. Hama'ayan is printed by Shalavim, and it was printed originally in the what's called here 4-1 Tishrei 1963, and the response from the anonymous Torah sage is found in Hama'ayan 6-4. 1966, took a couple of years to together it was written in Hebrew and it was translated by anonymous. And as Rabbi Lyman says, since his remarks were published anonymously, we will, in deference to his preference when he published them, quote them without revealing his identity.
He knew.
And in this is a very passionate, he quotes the Gaon of Mendel Kargo and the Aruch HaNer. They went to the University of Würzburg together. And Chacham Bernays of Shamshon and Fall Hirsch. You cannot, it's an important point. He said, no rabbinic court, he said, ever banned secular study. Now that's a statement which is true, but doesn't capture the essence of the truth. They never made an absolute ban, but there's certainly many, many rabbinic courts who prohibited secular studies anywhere near Jewish studies. For sure, to have us both under the same roof were absolutely prohibited. Not a ban, they put a cheir, but it was prohibited. They that near halacha, and then they didn't like many things. So, this, I'm just going to read you his last paragraph. That's all. Those who wish to dedicate their lives to the study of Torah alone come under the category of the tribe of Levi, as described by Maimonides. But I worry about all the tribes of Israel. The vast majority of Jews cannot live with a ban on secular study. We need to provide institutions that service the needs of the majority of Jews, wherever they may be. Even as we view it a great mitzvah to support the minority who study Torah only. And so I say both approaches are well-grounded in the sources, both are necessary ingredients for the continued existence of the Jewish people in our time. The author is none other than Rav Shimon Schwab, Zichrono Livracha. He is the author. And after his Petira, it came to the light of Shnei Olaimin that he didn't want to attach his name because he didn't want to get involved in the Machlokes, which was raging. And then after he passed away, when that reason no longer applied, he got the blessing of the family to reveal the author. And when he reprinted this article in a separate booklet, he did in fact reveal it. So I'm not giving away any secrets that were not already in print before. We have concluded this evening's shiur. I want to thank you all for coming. We're going to go off the record because people don't want to sometimes speak out when. And after we do that, with the help of our thank you so much.
Yeah, I'm a whiz, a modern man. Yeah, I'm going to.